I dared to do something that I didn't expect that I wanted to do or didn't think it was something that was appropriate for me. This is a really hard job to be in. There's only 11,000 fishermen left in this country. There's only 4,000 boats. We are an endangered species for women, and things are different for women at a young age than they are for men. The sea asks nothing of you, just that you turn up and you give your full self. It does take you up, down, up, down, up, down, but that's what life's like.
Howdy, folks. I just wanted to say a massive thank you to all of you that have liked, subscribed, and left a review for this podcast. It is amazing, and your support means everything. I also want to say thank you to everyone who has become a Patreon member. If you're interested in becoming a Patreon member, then just head on over. A link will be in the description. And as a member, you get exclusive content that no one else gets access to. So it's really beneficial. If you love the podcast and you want more from our guests, for every episode that is on here, there'll be a bonus episode on Patreon. And finally, don't forget to head on over to www.shewdareswins.com and grab yourself some awesome merch. Yes, there's tons of hoodies and t-shirts. And use the code POD10 for 10% off your first order. Let's get back to the show.
Hello, welcome back to the She Dares Wins podcast. My guest today is Celine. Actually, you're the second guest. This is your second time on the She Dares Wins podcast.
It is.
So you don't escape now, because the question that everyone gets is, She Dares Wins.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me how you've dared and won.
I don't know if I did dare. This is the thing.
Your whole career is a dare.
It is a dare, I guess. How did I dare? I didn't. I did something. I followed my dream. There we go.
You followed your dream.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I dared to do something that I didn't expect that I wanted to do or didn't think it was something that was appropriate for me. And I guess I won because I'm still here doing it. I guess I won because I won an award one time for being Fisherman of the Year. It's something I'm incredibly proud of. I won because,
yes,
I get to do this.
Yeah,
I get to write a book. Yeah,
we should say that people probably would benefit from going and listening to the first podcast that we did.
Absolutely,
that talks about how you basically left your world behind, a career, and then started fishing, and this absolutely amazing journey that has happened since, and this incredible book.
Mm.
So I'm forcing people to go.
You can go and listen. You can go and listen to it. I mean, there's a lot of it in here.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, right. So you shouldn't listen to the first podcast. In fact, go and buy asses.
But yeah.
So my fishing life.
Yeah.
Okay, this is a big deal because this is your story. Tell me why the book.
Why the book? So fishing industry is incredibly complex. Being a woman in the fishing industry is incredibly, I don't want to say unique anymore, because there are more and more women actively joining, which is fantastic. In the 6 years I've been doing the job, I think we've gone from like 2 women on boats to probably more like 20 now.
Right.
And we're being seen, we're being recognised, and we're showing up. Fantastic. Now I've forgotten. Because I've gone off on a tangent. Why the book? And in my head, I needed to, or I certainly felt like this industry isn't very visible.
Right.
It's a job that's done out at sea, away from the public eye. And ultimately, fish is a public resource. And I feel that the public have a right to know what actually is happening out there and how this industry all pieces together. And in my own head, even I was struggling to get it straight because it's that complex when you start delving into licensing, quota, sizes of boats and why boats are certain sizes to do certain jobs. So I thought, I need to start writing this down and getting it into a timeline factor of this happened, then that happened, and this happened, and because of that, this. So I needed to do that. And I also needed to feel like I needed to empower more women into a real predominantly male space by sharing my own journey and how I've grown and I've changed as a result of being here and doing the job.
Yeah, your story, from what you see on Instagram, is inspiring just from what you put out there, your daily life.
Mm.
But the book lays it all out. Mm. And I don't think there'd be anyone that would read this that wouldn't be moved by your story, but also inspired. I don't know anything about fishing. Like, the closest I get is a fish finger and birds.
same
on me. But I'm fascinated by this now new world. I think you kind of undercredit yourself for the shining light that you put on being that woman in that typically male-dominated environment.
Mm.
And for me, there's going to be a lot of, I hope, young people that read this.
I hope so.
That then think, the seeds planted. Like, maybe that's something that I can do.
And it's not just women in the fishing industry. It's women everywhere. And it's having that self-confidence, maybe, to show up in a job that stereotypically has been done by men.
Yeah.
And even if you aren't what you believe to be capable in the first instance, you can become capable.
Yeah.
I talk about in the book my growth and how much I've changed. And in the beginning, I didn't have strength in my wrists to do up a pot, and my limbs were feeble and weak. But I've changed as a result of just trying. So I think it's that, having that self-confidence to show up and do something. If it's interesting to you, if it's something you think you want to do, then just go for it and just try it, because what have you got to lose?
Yeah.
I think it's that.
And on the scale of like 1 to 10, I feel like fishing is up there at a 10 in terms of you're on a boat with men in the industry, the harbour's full of men. Take me a little bit into that world. And what you would like people to take from it.
Do you want to hear a really funny little story?
Yeah,
give
us a story.
I was on the quay this morning, having my coffee, talking to Nige, who's the skipper. And Carl, one of the other fishermen, pulled up. And I was like, guys, I've got a hair appointment tomorrow, and I don't know whether to cut a fringe in or have it like this still. What do I do? And they were like,
ooh.
I was like, look, I don't get much time to see my friends who are girls. I need you to tell me what to do with my hair. And they're like, Carl was like, what's a fringe? And I was like, wow, this is what I'm working with. But ultimately, I think certainly some of the men in this industry have been really great at accepting me for me, mm-hmm. and the fact that I'm a woman and I'm going to be different and I'm going to ask different questions, whether that's something challenging, that's female orientated in a fishing way, or whether that's me asking, hey, do I get a fringe cut in, or do I leave these kind of bangs, curtain bangs that I've got going on? People, they don't know what a curtain bang is. And I think that for the most part, most men have been really accepting to see me showing up and doing the job.
Yeah.
And in some cases, certainly I've had praise for doing that and for using my voice, which is more one of the unique ones, to speak up about the fishing industry.
Yeah.
And certainly open up the fishing industry for the general public, that they can understand what we do and how we do it and why we do it.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the men in this industry are like, yeah, keep going. We need this. We need visibility. We need people to see us, because we're facing quite a lot of difficulties that are up and coming, and we need voices. There's only 11,000 fishermen left in this country. There's only 4,000 boats.
That's insane. Mm.
We are an endangered species. That's how I see it anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And your relationship with Norwich in the book, like, is so special.
Mm.
Do you think it's a one-off, or do you think that there are other champions out there?
There are other Niges. But the problem with The problem with Nigers is that a noun now? Has Nige become a noun?
I got some questions about Nigel.
Yeah.
I went to.
The problem with Nigers is they are these undersung heroes, and actually they're men that champion women, mm-hmm. and that they empower them and they make them push themselves to be the best that they can be. And oftentimes they just float along under the radar, quietly in the ear of every woman that's perhaps breaking a boundary somewhere, going, go on, you can do it.
Yeah.
You can do this. You can do that. And just putting that confidence into them quietly, just bobbing along, doing their own thing, probably not even realizing that what they're doing is so important and so special. And to all the secret Nigers out there, we thank you.
Yeah. And I said that I could completely relate to this. I was like, I work with like hundreds of Nigers.
Yeah.
And they're the ones that show up and push you forward and enable you to do what the... And I think, would you say to girls out there that want to kind of go into it, you just got to find your Nige.
You've just got to find your Nige.
We should put on a t-shirt.
Find your Nige.
It's going to be women around the country.
Yeah, like, no. But, you know, men have such an important role to play in women empowerment.
Yeah.
Because they do champion. They do see... And they think, yeah, okay, this girl's got something and she can do it. And they see you no different to a man. They might just give you that little extra push that perhaps we didn't get when we were younger because we were women and things are different for women at a young age than they are for men.
Yeah.
And they just give you that little extra push along to say, okay, you can do that. You can do this. And it's the language that they use sometimes. It's all you need. It's... They just ask you to do something and assume you can do it, which is empowering in itself.
Yeah.
So, okay, you can do that, or you can do this. And it's like, can I? If he says I can, then I must be able to.
Which you say, just talk about in the book.
Yes.
And you talk about you always have confidence when Nige said,
yeah,
go ahead. That's the nod that you're ready for it.
Yeah, that's, okay, you can do this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the small things. It's not the constant... It's the unsaid thing.
It is. It is. And there's a chapter at the end of the book, and, you know, no spoilers here, where you can very clearly see that whole dynamic and kind of like the sort of cherry on top of the whole transition of me and this... I don't want to give away spoilers.
No. No,
but there is, okay, there's a cherry on top moment.
Okay.
Where, you know, Nige is as best as he can Nige. Yeah. And definitely empowers me to feel differently about myself.
Right.
So,
yeah.
No spoilers.
No spoilers.
I just wanted to take a moment to say a massive thank you to this week's episode sponsor, Extra Tough Boots. Discover the resilience of Extra Tough Boots, where top-notch quality meets unparalleled comfort. Born on the wild seas of Alaska almost 75 years ago, Extra Tough range of 100% waterproof footwear has established itself as the go-to brand for durable and reliable footwear. Trusted by commercial fishermen, pro surfers, ice water swimmers, and outdoor enthusiasts alike, Extra Tough Boots truly are Alaskan proven, built for all. I too can personally say that Extra Tough Boots are awesome. My experience of wearing them is just ultimate comfort, and they truly can be put to the test in the outdoor environment. So head on over to the Extra Tough website at www.extratough.co.uk and use the promo code 24 She Who Dares Wins 25 for 25% off site wide. That's incredible. Thank you, Extra Tough. Now let's get back to the show.
And I think it's important to say that you didn't come from... We were chatting earlier about women that, or girls who have been around the industry that they then go into. Mm-hmm. It's actually a small proportion that come from an outside into something new, which your story plays out really nicely because that is exactly what happened to you. And I think that's going to give a lot of women confidence, you know, if they're so far from where they want to be.
Yeah.
That it doesn't matter. You don't have to have grown up with boats. No. You don't have to have grown up like knowing about the sea.
Mm-hmm.
You are.
I was completely green to it.
Yeah.
Completely green to it. Because it is such a generational job. You know, we were chatting off camera young people who have been brought up in this world or brought up in this sector would have been messing around in boats since they were, you know, tiny. So it becomes natural to them to then take a boat or to do the job because they've already understood it from their parents, from their grandparents, and been around it. And I came in with none of that.
Yeah.
But it was still absolutely accessible to me as long as I was willing to learn. And because there is so much to learn and it's all so interesting and so, well, I find it interesting, everything's so different. So it's not just learning about boats. It's learning about weather. It's learning about tides. It's learning about fish. It's learning about methods of catching fish. It's learning about our legislative processes. There's so many different things and so many different aspects that keeps your mind constantly nimble. She's like, oh, today I'm going to learn about this. Every day.
That's the one thing that I took from the book as well, is that stupidly I was like, oh, you just go out and get fish.
Yeah.
Oh my God, there is so much water. And it's incredibly dangerous.
Yeah.
So, like, I've been watching your Instagram with the pots flying out the back, and I was just like, yeah, I mean, that's high speed, but just explain to somebody, you know, I guess the repercussions of the pots not being lined up properly.
Yeah. Or the rope not being looked at. Yeah. So if you think that you've got half a mile of rope on deck and probably anywhere between 20 to 50 pots, and they have to go out the back door in the reverse order of with which they came onto the boat. And sometimes that will require human intervention. So actually physically, like, moving the pot to where the hole is in the back of the boat.
Right.
And to start the whole process off, you have to chuck an anchor so that your pots will stay on the seabed where you left them. Otherwise, they die forever. And no one wants that. A, environment, B, money. And once you start that process going, it's sort of rope, pot, rope, pot, rope, pot. You're not going to be able to stop that because, you know, tide, weather, boat moving. And there has been occasions, don't get me wrong, where pots have tried to, like, go out, like, two, three, four at a time, even more in whelk pots sometimes. And sometimes you just have to go, get out of the way and just let them go, and you'll deal with that the next time you haul it. And it might be that there's a great big ball of, like, I think I say it in the book, it's like spaghetti and meatballs, it's like pots and we'll throw a ball, like, wrapped around each other. And there's been times where the rope has sort of snagged on something, you know, on the boat. So we've had it in the past where it's been a fairly rolly kind of a day. We've been shooting pots out the back door, and the riddle, which we use to grade the whelks, has got legs, and it's normally sort of cable tied to the side of the boat.
Right.
And it's been really rust. Cable tie's gone. The riddle's fallen over. The rope's going. The rope's rope will fight. If it can, it will. It's found the leg and it's dragged the riddle down the stern. Nigel's shooting crab gear away. I'm in the wheel, Assie. You do have to take the boat out of gear and try and go astern just to try and bring yourself back and just allow some sort of slack on the rope so you could maybe just get that riddle free, because that's not going to fit through that hole in the back door. And eventually, you know, you have to kind of keep yourself out the way, and in that moment you have to think quick, do quick, and then hopefully get on. And then we got it free, you know, which was done. And then you carry on, and then you go to the next one, and I say to Nigel, be nice and tight next day, like, so you shot it, because obviously you've been like trying to hold the boat there while everything's kind of opposing forces. So
it's a dangerous environment to be in.
Yeah,
add that to the pressure is, you know, it's money on the table, isn't it, if you come in and you've not caught anything.
Yeah.
The ebbs and flows, the heartbreak.
You could be a millionaire one week. A millionaire might be a bit rich, but
yeah,
you can be doing really, really well one week, and the next week you can be destitute because of the weather. And it's really hard to try and financially plan based on those factors, because you are completely at the mercy of what the weather's going to do, especially when you're in a small boat. If you're in a big boat, maybe not so much, because they can push more weather.
Yeah.
But yeah, you are completely... Ask me what I'm doing next week.
Yeah.
Not my day. I can give you a sort of a best guess estimate.
But that's where I think it plays into the love of whenever you read about your passion for fish to see the job.
Mm.
There has to be that passion.
Oh, it has to be. Completely. If you did it for the money. You'd have been from the door. But I joke. There are people that do really, really well, and there's a lot of money to be made from the fish in the sea. Am I one of those people? No.
She's part of the Ferrari around the back. But the calling to, you talk about this calling to go out and to leave your job.
Mm.
Was that really just after that one fishing trip?
Well, it was. Like, I kept going back and doing more fishing trips. And then it was like, Nigel's like, my son's going to leave me and go work on a commercial boat. Do you want to help or be my crew? And I was like, got a job. And, you know, it was a very sort of soft launch into it. So it's like, yeah, weekends and annual leave, I'll come give you a hand. And then the next year it was like, I need 3 months off work to do this. And then when he got rid of that angling boat, it was him on a commercial boat and I'd go out and watch and sit on the wheelhouse roof and watch him and the boys buzzing around on deck. And then it got to the point where it's like, I love being out here. I think it's because as well, I was in an office where people were asking things from me all the time. Phone was ringing. Ash, can you do this? Ash, I've got a problem here. Can you solve this? Emails, this, you need to do this. I've got this problem, that problem. I didn't get bombarded with that out there. It was, okay, out here, you are you. And you don't have to be anything because the sea doesn't care. You only have to be yourself and bring your true self to the party. And I think it was just such a stark contrast. And I think I just needed it. I just needed that reflection rather than having to be this person that went into an office, had to look a certain way, dress a certain way, act a certain way, consider other people's emotions, consider what my choices that I made at that day in work was going to affect all the other people around me. Whereas out there, it was completely different to that. It was natural. It was raw. It was the sea asks nothing of you, just that you turn up and you give your full self, not this version of the person that they expect you to be. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah. That is one of the quotes that stuck out to me in the book. Yeah. It was when it was like, you know, Mother Nature, the sea doesn't care who you are, how much money you have, what you look like. It's how you deal with
it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's that sense of just, you think, without sounding cheesy, you think you kind of found you through the job?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely, I did. Because you don't get any outside input. There's no society out there. We don't even listen to the radio. You know, it's a playlist or nothing. So it's that isolation with yourself, and I think it's so important. And you exist in not just your mind. So when I sat in an office all day, I was just relying on my brain propel me through the day.
Yeah.
So I felt like I just lived in there. Whereas out there, I need all of me. I need what's in here. I need strength of my arms, hands, feet, legs. So I'd come home at, you know, after doing a day and I'm like, I'm exhausted. Everything in me is exhausted. It was so nice. Not just living in here all the time.
Yeah. And I guess being out at sea when it's just the two of you as well, everything is like heightened.
Magnified.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You talk about some of the experiences where, you know, it is dangerous out there and the relationship between you and Knife, like the skipper,
is
at the end of the day,
absolutely
falls on the skipper. And there's that, I say hierarchy, it's not really, is it? Because you're ultimately a team, but
his word is final.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this
and he's judge, jury, and executioner, really.
Yeah.
And you kind of have to accept that because somebody has to stand up and say, hey, do you know what? I'm going to be the person that's responsible. Everybody's safety on this.
Yeah.
Whether that be just us two, whether that be three, four, however many people, whatever boat, anywhere, someone has to be the responsible person. It's always the skipper.
Yeah. And it is like the relationship that blossoms throughout the book.
Mm.
It's so hard because I want to be like, this is everything that happened. I spoil it. it is incredible. And your kind of love for, I think it's great that you've then used your platform to not only inspire others, to other women to kind of get into the industry if there's an interest in theirs, but then also to talk about things, I guess some fishermen might not have the confidence to do, which is everything behind the fishing. So like the politics. And where did that come from? Was that initially at the start? Were you like, well, hold on a minute, we're learning stuff that people need to know about? Or has that just come?
I think I'm naturally like quite inquisitive. And if I'm working in an industry, I kind of need to understand how it works, especially when that industry is broken. I was in my old job, in my old company, I did a lot of time in like quality control and things like that, and a lot of time in like process mapping and flow charts. So I've
so far from it, and you're so far from it, yeah.
But fundamentally, I needed to understand how everything fitted together. And I'd pick up these little nuggets and little chunks of information from other fishermen, and but that doesn't make sense to me. Why not? So I'd go on my own little deep dive, and I'd be like, oh, I've learned something like this. Oh, I've learned that. Okay, so that's like that because of this. And it got to the point in my head where I had this big jigsaw puzzle, and I had all the pieces, but I couldn't make them fit together. Mm. So I had to really sit down and think about what I'd learned and where it all sat in this big fisheries timeline. And then you end up with this.
Yeah.
And actually writing this was so cathartic because it was like, okay, that, then this, then that, then this. And then it all made sense to me. Ah, pennies dropped. And I just needed to get it out of my head in this big jumble into something that made sense. And the more I looked at it, the more scared I got for where our industry has been, the more upset I was about what fishermen before me have had to deal with.
Right.
And the more worried I got about the future.
Yeah.
Because we can't keep going down this same path where we lose fishermen from the industry every year, and we lose boats from the industry every year because people are struggling.
Yeah.
And because otherwise we'll end up with no fishing fleet, and we'll just import everything that we eat. And we are an island nation. We have one of the, I think we have the biggest multi-species fishery in the world. Yeah. And all this fish is so, so important to us. Oh, we can't lose it. We just can't.
Let's throw that stat in here, because I think that's really important. So I was shocked. Was it 80% of fish
vote is from England?
Yeah.
And we only generally eat the same five species of fish as a nation.
We are.
Oh, I knew them, so. Cod, haddock, salmon, tuna. And I want to say prawns.
Oh, okay.
I want to say prawns. Yeah. I could be wrong. I probably have to Google that. Infill here. Michelle will do some research. Or I will do some research and we'll put it up on the screen.
Yeah.
But either way, it's like prawns are all imported. I'm sure I saw one year that we exported as much cod as we imported.
I was going to say, how much did we import in? Which just seems crazy. And I'm like shameless here. I had to Google what a whelk was.
Yeah.
Because I was like, what? The fishing what?
Yeah.
And then it was actually my uncle who is a fisherman. He was like, oh, they're like, he loves them. They're little snails.
The great whelk.
Yeah. And he's like, he absolutely loves them.
I feel like I need t-shirts for the people that like whelks. Yeah. Like, I heart whelks.
But your whelks go abroad then.